recording session. Have a seat. Have a cup of tea. Have a glass of water. We're about to start. Hope you enjoy the collaborations. Hope you become familiar with the sounds and the intenseness of expression. Just sit back and relax. This is about getting up in the morning and feeling good with a new day and a new chance to create. Okay? So may the deserts have water. May the storms calm down. May the snows lighten up. May the babies laugh. And may your ears remain open. So in poetry, in music, in knowledge, in peace, security, and longevity, come on and step into the time flow with us. Come on, let's go. Let's go.
And you're listening to Saturday Morning Live. This is Mally, aka Docu Vixen, and it is another day. Yeah, we're here. I made it.
Yeah. So we rediscovered Jane Cortez, our theme song, which is a beautiful thing. And today we have we're going to be speaking with L. Jones from Halifax, Nova Scotia, at 12 o'clock. At 11:30, we're going to be speaking to Amit Lowe of the Gorilla Group, and we're going to be speaking with Herb Boyd about Malcolm Shabazz, the current or the newest developments in the death of Malcolm X's grandson. I think we have Angela Gilliam. She's going to be speaking about Amiel Cabral. This is a piece that was done in 2003, pardon me. And we're going to begin, like we begin every week, with Mumia Abu-Jamal. But I think this is going to be an interview with Lynn Stewart. And she's interviewed by Noel Hanrahan, who I had the pleasure of meeting in Los Angeles when I was there. So this, let us go with, you can introduce it, Molly.
Yeah, so we're going to Mumia Abu-Jamal via Prison Radio, and we're going to go to that interview right now.
Now, you were saying earlier that when they came for Lynn, you thought they were coming for your husband.
Yes, he's been, quote, an activist, is that the word? For many, many years, always around schools, trying to restore community to the schools. So when they came for me, I heard him arguing with people that I knew were law enforcement just by the cut of their suits. And I heard him saying, I don't see a warrant. I don't see your badges anywhere. And I came to the front door and I said, Ralph, take it easy. Take it easy. It's be okay. We'll go to the office. We'll straighten everything out. Don't get a resisting arrest on top of everything else. And the FBI guy walked up very angry and said, we're not here for him. We're here for you. So it was pretty heavy duty. As I say, being a criminal lawyer, I knew I didn't want them in my house particularly. So I stepped out, handed Ralph my bag, and went for a very silent trip to the headquarters in Manhattan, where I knew better, as we are explaining to our clients all the time, than to speak to them at all. So I had no idea what I was really being arrested for, although they at some point did show me an arrest warrant, which said, conspiring to materially aid a terrorist organization. And later in the day, of course, my lawyer came in with the indictment, which I still read over with some degree of astonishment, because as my lawyer, Michael Tiger, says, there really is no crime in this indictment. There is a press release. There is a point at which I signed on to an agreement that I didn't subsequently keep, I guess. That's according to them anyway.
For our listeners, let me take them back just a moment.
Sure.
So that we can tell them who your client was.
In 1995, I tried the case of Sheikh Omar Abdelrahman. He has always been associated with the World Trade Center, but he has never actually been charged with that, which comes as a surprise to a lot of people. He never had any case to make against him. But I think that constant repeat of a picture of him in his dark glasses with the World Trade Center smoking behind him.
Now, tell me, what was he convicted of when you were his lawyer?
We tried a case in which an informant had organized and paid for through FBI funds a group to blow up, supposedly, New York City landmarks. At one point in this long, year-long conspiracy, this informant, who was also working for the Egyptian government, one of the most repressive on the face of the globe, approached the sheikh and asked him about certain targets. Islamically, he's an Islamic scholar. Is this target appropriate or is that target appropriate? And he responded, because under Islamic law, they must respond to any question that is put to them on this kind of an issue. That was really the gravamen of his offense. There were other informants that came forward and gave testimony that was come see, come saw about whether or not he had actually done anything. But notwithstanding that, the tenor of the times, even then in 1995, was such that this jury clearly did not want him walking the streets. And as a result, he was convicted.
Now, did you take up his appeal?
Well, we had had a legal team from day one. I was to be the trial lawyer, the first seat, and conduct the trial with Abdin Jabara, who is founder of the Arab American Anti-Defamation League, and Ramsey Clark along on board. We had also a group of paralegals and an interpreter, and we were the legal team. When he, after his conviction and sentencing, Ramsey took over, his office took over the appeal. He did write the appeal. That period lasted for about another 3 years or so, during which the appeal was pending and was turned down by the Second Circuit. Then there was a period of a Supreme Court appeal that was also turned down. So by the spring of 2000, we still functioned as a defense team, but we were more concerned with his prison conditions, the way in which he was able to communicate or not communicate.
Well, now, since those are some of the real details, tell me, what were his conditions and what role did you play, and then what happened?
Soon after his conviction, actually, while he was still on appeal, the Bureau of Prisons issued a group of regulations. These are called special administrative measures. They are special rules to govern certain prisoners. Leonard Pelletier is also governed by these special rules. We all know Leonard is totally innocent of everything he's ever been charged with, but he also is limited. In the Sheikh's case, he was limited in his ability to communicate with the outside world. We were not permitted to have anyone listen in on any of his phone conversations. He was only permitted to call his lawyers once a week, his family once a month for 15 minutes. His family calls were terminated at one point because he spoke to a son about a political issue that was happening in Egypt. He was then thereafter only allowed to speak to his wife. With regard to our conversations, they asked each time he called, the secretary was not permitted to answer the phone, only the lawyer, and you were asked, is there anyone else in the room with you? Is there anyone on a third line? Is this going on a three-way call? To which we all, you know, would respond negatively, and then the call would go through. We also visited him in jail. We were allowed, of course, to visit. He got no other visitors. His only visitors were his family, who would never get a visa from the American government to leave Egypt and come here, except on one occasion. In the approximately 13 years he's now been in jail, did he have a family visit in the jail from his family. So as a result of all of this, we continued to represent him within the SAMs, but also we understood that our job as his lawyers were to keep him in touch with the outside world, that he was a major personage in the Middle East, someone respected because he was absolutely incorruptible, that he could not be bought off by many of the secular governments to bend the Quran to their liking. And he was, of course, mainly concerned with Egypt, his own country, and the Mubarak regime, which we know to be one of the most repressive on the face of the earth. Torture and imprisonment and holding people hostage until other people surrender. Notwithstanding all of that, we regularly, the legal team, operated together to keep him on the forefront. But it was in the May of 2000 when I released a press release from him that I had been given when I was in the jail through our interpreter. It was at that point that it had to do with a ceasefire currently in effect in Egypt between an organization the Sheikh had been associated with and the Egyptian government. It was at that point that the government said, you made a press release, you broke the special administrative measures, you did this thing, and you're not allowed to visit anymore, you're not allowed to take any phone calls. This was not a surprise. We expected that might happen, although the press release was purely what it was. It was not, as the government has now characterized it, passing of secrets. Ron Kuby said, you know, if it was Abdullah pick up the shipment at the palm tree at midnight, that might be a secret message. This was done through Reuters. It was done over the phones. It was absolutely overt.
No, but you didn't get into the larger amount of trouble at this point. John Ashcroft did not cook up your indictment. Yeah. What led to that, and why do you think you were targeted?
Well, thereafter was when the surveillance began of our attorney client. All the conversations on the phone were listened to as well.
Now, and also, now, what does this mean? Now, are you aware that this has ever happened before in terms of, and what constitutional violations are they?
Well, you know, as activist lawyers, I must say we always suspect the government of listening in anytime we talk to an activist client. Not legally in the sense that they can take evidence from that and go to court with it, but listening in for their own informational purposes. Notwithstanding that, we have conversations. We do talk about potential witnesses. We do talk about conditions, lawsuit, or whatever is at that time of importance to the client, whatever at that time within the reign of representation should be brought forward on his behalf. So in the Sheikh's case, they basically started listening about 6 months later. And the importance of this is that when the government becomes a third ear, there is no longer trust possible between the attorney and the client, because how can he trust his lawyer if the material is being shared with the government? It also makes impossible a fair trial, because the government is able to go see your witnesses, if that's what you're talking at, know your strategy, know what's going to be brought out, what isn't going to be brought out. It undermines this very imperfect justice system that we have, but it undermines it in such an important way that it, in essence, destroys the right to defend. If the government is part of every attorney-client conversation, it inhibits the attorney's ability to defend, but more importantly, it destroys the kind of confidence a client must have in that attorney to defend, to tell the heartfelt secrets, to say not only exculpatory, but perhaps even inculpatory material, which you would need to know in order to defend a person. So it is fundamental. There is no lawyer in the world that won't say it is not fundamental to the defense of a client. There is no lawyer in the world who won't say it's fundamental to representation, period. So it is really an assault on the ability to defend, on the ability to have a lawyer that goes into court to fight for you.
And one thing, so it can be concretized for people, or people can really understand what it might mean. In Mumia's case, they confiscated his legal mail from Len Wineglass. So they had a complete outline of the case before Mumia filed his habeas corpus appeal. They also knew the day that he was going to go to court and file it. So they preemptively signed his death warrant. And they effectively cut short his ability to have a hearing on new evidence to a much shorter time window because he was under a sentence of death and it moved much more quickly. So there are real key things that can be compromised.
Absolutely. And that is a marvelous example because, of course, Mumia had tremendous public support, still does, and was placed in this position of having to undermine his ability to defend. That is really exactly what we are talking about. And it was able to be done by interfering with the attorney-client privilege. You know, people talking about what has been happening in the last few years say that this is much worse than what happened in the 50s. In the 50s, they attacked people because of association. But this government and the government of Pennsylvania as well and other states are willing to attack the very Constitution in order to get to where they want to go. They're willing to say there should be no Fifth Amendment, there should be no Sixth Amendment. At least in the 50s, people were entitled to say, I take the Fifth or I take the First Amendment in order to defend myself.
Have you ever met John Ashcroft? Did you just see him on TV?
No, I'm happy to say I've only seen him on TV, and that's been more than enough. Well, I think the most amazing thing about Ashcroft is that his ambition is so naked, that he would go on the Letterman show. It's so completely outside the realm of even an Ed Meese or a John Mitchell. To go on this wildly popular late-night show to announce to the world that Lynn Stewart is guilty and he's protecting the world. It really does. If you think about it, it's almost Hollywood. It's almost right out of some kind of bad PR dream. But that is what happened. And as someone said, not incidentally, to poison any possible jurors who might have been listening that night as well.
What charges do you face and what's the potential sentence if you're convicted?
I'm charged with conspiracy to materially aid a terrorist organization, which is their elastic charges, which they have brought against almost every person that they have arrested in connection with the war on terrorism. Then I am also charged with actually materially aiding a terrorist organization. Both of these referred to the press conference. I also am accused of lying to the government, which is a charge that is brought in connection with the SAMs that I signed on to and then made the press release.
And tell us what a SAMs is.
The SAM is the Special Administrative Measure. It's a prison regulation that's brought by the Department of Justice. There's no judicial review. There's no appeal of it. It's just promulgated, and it's a take-it-or-leave-it basis. If you don't take it, then you can't see your client. So in this instance, it was more important to see the client. But I don't think anyone ever expected that it resulted in an indictment if you broke a SAM. I mean, we all thought maybe it would mean you'd be barred, you might not be able to represent the person, but never that you would be indicted for that misdoing, if indeed it is a misdoing.
What potential exposure do you have in terms of sentencing?
I'm facing 40 years. That's a maximum sentence. But the government was kind enough to tell my children when they signed my bail bond that I only faced 18 under the guidelines. I will smile at this. We're on radio. They can't see us. But to me, it's not a question. It's a question of it's a must-win situation. Not for me, but for everyone, for all the activists that rely on the lawyers, for everyone, we must win this case.
Why would they pick on a little old grandmother?
I had this argument with my defense committee, actually. They wanted to play up the grandmother, and I said, They didn't pick the grandmother. They picked the activist, the 40-year activist, that young woman that came to Harlem and was so astounded by what she saw there. She couldn't believe she was still in America, that no one had ever told her that this is how black people were forced to live, and who has never retreated from that position, who has said, if they lied to me about that, what else are they lying about? Whoops, here comes Vietnam. Well, that's on the agenda now. And then through the next 40 years with Ralph fighting that lie and for the people.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. chambers of non-stop insanity, patrolled by Captain America's Boogaloo Incorporated in integrated suicidal settings. Africa is burning, and the black man is doing the freak. My brothers and sisters dressed up in punctual attire, not realizing that it's more to being black than just talking about it. Africa is burning, and the black man is doing the freak. Tight jeans and Elton John sunglasses, Pierre Cardin sneakers and a bag of smoke. Africa is burning, and the black man is doing the freak.
When they think they have nothing of their own, when they think they have nothing of their own. I'm taking the blues back home. I'm taking the blues back home. I'm taking the blues back to the fire of the spirit. I'm taking the blues back to the damp undergrowth. I'm taking the blues back to where the blues stealers won't go. I'm taking the blues back home. I'm taking the blues back home. I'm taking the blues back home. I'm taking the blues out of the mouth of the stealers. I'm taking the blues out of the western spring. I'm taking the blues back home. I'm taking the blues back home. I'm taking the blues back home before somebody sings. Ain't nobody's business if I steal your blues. I'm taking the blues back home. I'm taking the blues back home. I'm taking the blues back home. Before Robert Johnson comes from the graveyard to say the blues has been crapped on. I'm taking the blues back home. I'm taking the blues back to the crossroads. I'm taking the blues back to the bush. I'm taking the blues back to the place where the blues stealers won't go. I'm taking the blues back home. I'm taking the blues back home before Langston Hughes returns to say they're taking my blues again and gone. I'm taking the blues back home. I'm taking the blues back home. I'm the owner of the blues and I'm taking the blues back home. I'm taking the blues back home. I'm taking the blues, I'm taking the blues, I'm taking the blues back home, I'm taking the blues back home, I'm taking the blues back home. The blues that came to me from the slave dungeons, the blues that came to me from the death trails, the blues that came to me from my ancestors, the blues that came to me in a spell that tells me through prayer that I'm the owner of the blues from a long time ago. I'm the owner of the blues from a long time ago, from a long, 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 long time ago. I'm the owner of the blues. They have a right to sing the blues. I'm still the owner of the secrets in the blues. From a long time ago, from a long time ago, from a long time ago, from a long time ago. I'm the owner of the blues, I'm the owner of the blues. And even if somebody pays to play and use the blues, I'm still the owner of the blues. From a long time ago, from a long time ago, from a long time ago. I'm the owner of the blues from a long time ago. And I'm taking the blues, I'm taking the blues, I'm taking the blues back home. I'm taking the blues back home. I'm taking the blues back to where the blues stealers won't go. I'm taking the blues back to where the blues stealers won't go. I'm taking the blues back home. I'm taking the blues back home. I'm taking the blues back home. I'm taking the blues back home.
I'm speaking with Puma Sajoli.
Sajola.
Puma, yes, Sajola. Yes, and you are one of the three tenors who will be coming to Toronto this Saturday.
Yes, sir. There's been so many things that's held us down, but now it looks like things are finally coming around. I know we've got a long, long way to go, and where we'll end up, I don't know. But we won't let nothing hold us back. We're putting our show together, we're polishing up our act. And if you've ever been held down before, I know you refuse to be held down anymore. Trying to make it, they only push you aside. They really don't have nowhere to go. Ask them where they're going, they don't know. But we won't let nothing hold us back. We're gonna put our show together, gonna polish up our act now. And if you've ever been held down before, I know you refuse to be held down anymore.
We won't. keep us down.